Good evening and welcome. It's KBC Arts. I'm David Fleming. Tonight we'll hear from Kent Hartman, author of Goodnight LA, The Rise and Fall of Classic Rock, the untold story from inside the legendary recording studios. Many behind-the-scenes stories with this one. To start, though, I spoke with Vicki Goodglick, marketing and events manager at Lake Arrowhead Village, about the upcoming summer concert series and much more. I found out that Vicki's in a band of singing storytellers appearing at the original Renaissance Pleasure Fair in Irwindale coming up soon. That's not the only band, though. There's Vicki G and the Dudes. That's
Yeah, it's a local band up here in the mountains mostly, and we play around town mostly, and we've played the Redlands Fireman's Car Show a couple times and that kind of thing. So, we just have a good time. We play some corporate events and things like that. We play a lot of covers and a few originals and all that kind of stuff. So we just have a good time.
Yeah, I went through the sample song list. I wasn't quite sure if it was purely a cover band, just having fun kind of thing, because there's some impressive resumes, particularly, I should say, with Dean Cortez. We've got Boss Gags in Hiroshima currently.
Yeah, sometimes we get lucky enough to have our keyboard player, Kimo. He plays with Hiroshima also. Yeah. And Roy Sweden, our drummer, also is a quite accomplished producer and musician. Everybody's just stellar, just really good musicians. And yeah, we play because we like to have a good time.
Okay. Now, also, there's a Renaissance Fair, a folk group, The Story Wrens.
Yeah, The Story Wrens, Storywrens, like the bird.
Absolutely.
I've been in that group for about 8 or 9 years, and we perform mostly at Renaissance Fairs, Northern California, Southern California, Simi Valley, San Luis Obispo, and things like whiskey tastings, and we just performed at the Queen Mary for the Scottish Festival Games, stuff like that. It's kind of a unique folk kind of period songs with lots of harmonies and traditional instruments, you know, dulcimer and harp and fiddle and things like that. It's really fun. It's really challenging because we do a lot of kind of heavy harmony kind of stuff, but it's also just really fun because we basically tell story songs. We sing story songs. So each song pretty much has a story to it. And a lot of the times it's about sailors and mermaids and dragons and and love, lots of love stories and things like that. And it's quite entertaining and quite fun and challenging for me. So I really enjoy it. It's satisfying musically for me. Both bands really are, but they're very different.
Oh, yeah, I'd say. And now with The Story Wrens, what's the lineup on this one?
It depends, but we usually have 3 or 4. I basically mostly just sing, and the other members, Shauna and Mark, they're married, and they play everything. They're just multi-instrumentalists. Shauna plays the harp and penny whistle and flutes and things like that,
and
a little bit of fiddle, and Mark plays fiddle and cello and mandolin and dulcimer.
Yeah, all the strings,
We have a bass player when we can. It always fills out the sound nicely.
Now, one of the Renaissance fairs coming up that you guys are involved with, that's the SoCal Ren Fair coming up in April.
It's April 7th, I think, and it goes through about May 20th, I think. It's about 7 weekends. I think we're going to be there about 5 out of the 7 weekends.
Oh, wow.
The first 3, I think, and the last 2, so we'll miss a week or 2 in the middle. But we'll be there. The Story Wrens, look us up.
Where is this one?
In Irwindale, behind
the... Oh, the big one, right.
Yeah, in Irwindale at the Santa Fe Dam Recreation Area.
Oh.
It's pretty big.
Yes.
So wear your walking shoes.
Oh, yeah. So that's fantastic. Okay. That's coming up early April, and we'll be going for quite a few weekends. Okay.
Yeah.
Now let's talk about the summer concert series.
We start in May. Hopefully the snow will be gone by that time. So it's usually the end of May. This year it's May 18th. We're starting, and it goes through September 8th this year. So there's about 40 concerts all summer long, Fridays and Saturday nights, and on holiday weekends. So if Monday's a holiday, we'll have a Sunday night concert, and then on Monday, if that's a holiday, we might have an afternoon concert.
Hmm.
It's a free concert series. You can come watch it. There's standing room and a dance floor, and there's a lawn where you can bring a chair or a blanket and watch the concert for free. Or we do have some tables, and you can reserve seating and purchase a reserved table at the concert series. And we have a beer garden where the beer garden opens an hour before the concerts, and you can buy beer and wine and sodas and whatnot. Yeah, it's quite enjoyable. It's mostly tribute bands, and that seems to work well up here. Everybody likes to see music they know and love. Every once in a while, we'll have something a little different, but for the most part, it's a lot of really, really great tribute bands, the best in SoCal.
Absolutely,
We're lucky to get a lot of the good ones.
Oh, truly. Now, I'm seeing a lot of these. I mean, really, a lot of them that are returning. Folks, just to name a few of them, not for any reason other than that's the first ones my eyes are catching, but Paperback Writer, Tribute to the Beatles, Masters of Puppets, there's a Metallica one. Which one's Pink? Pink Floyd tribute band. And some of these, I have to say, these are folks that make their living as a tribute band. So this is, you know, not just something some folks are doing for this summer up here at Lake Arad.
Oh, yeah, they're pros. The musicians and bands, they're pros. They've been around. They've played casinos and traveled and all that kind of stuff. There are quite a few. I've talked to a lot of the band members, and there are quite a few that have day jobs as well. But, you know, you have to do a little bit of both.
Yeah.
But a lot of them are touring and playing a lot around Southern California and beyond.
Were you around when the Summer Concert Series became pretty much a 99.9% tribute band?
No, I think that was before my time. I don't really know exactly what they did beforehand off the top of my head, but they've always kind of had a smattering of tribute bands, and I think it's just gotten to be a bigger deal over the last few years for sure. You know, it's almost an industry now.
Oh, my gosh. Well, no, it is. It is. Some folks, we mentioned your band earlier as a cover band, and now we're talking about these tribute bands. So some folks don't think about cover band versus tribute band. If you would go into this for us, there's a couple of different people listening this time. So the difference is, you know, between the two things.
A tribute band is a band that specifically plays a specific band's music. You know, they tribute ZZ Top or Fleetwood Mac or Elton John, and they do just songs by them. Some of them may dress up like them or may, you know, put on a show as if, you know, kind of acting like they are them.
Mm-hmm.
And some bands just are playing their music as a tribute. So some do and some don't do the costumes, but they would still be a tribute band if they're really dedicating their show to a specific classic rock or what have you band. A cover band is more general. They play songs by a lot of different artists, and they kind of, you know, maybe do top 40 and maybe classic rock, or maybe they play a little bit of everything, and you can't really say they're a tribute to anyone in specific, so that would be just a regular cover band.
Well stated. Now, I read that the footprint for the concert area, this is larger. Is this basically because of the tent being gone, or is it truly a larger area?
Well, we used to kind of confine, because you have to confine the alcohol consumption to a specific area.
Yes.
So we used to confine it just to around the tables and the grass area. You know, we left the walkways to the sides open for people to walk back and forth along the shops, because the shops line both sides of the peninsula and people would be walking by. And so we tried to confine the alcohol to just kind of right in front of the stage area. But we have opened it up a little wider, and we have our barricades at the beginning of the peninsula and then a little further back, halfway down the peninsula. So those walkways are sort of included in that area at the moment. You do get your bag checked by security when you come in, because you can't bring in outside alcohol and things like that. But you don't have to pay to get in the gate or anything like that. You could just walk through. But it does allow for just what feels like a little more elbow room, what feels like just a little more space for people to stand around or sit and watch the concert. So it feels more spacious, and there definitely is more square footage to the area where the alcohol is limited to.
I also read that you can also have table beer and wine service. That is, they'll bring it to you.
Yeah, it used to be where you had to come to the line and wait in line to get your beers and stuff, and we thought, well, you know, maybe we should try going out to you guys and bringing you your beers if you'd like. So we've added that service. We can't always accommodate it just because our staff is limited, but if we can, we try to get a couple of the beer garden staff people to go out and ask the tables if they need anything. And so, yeah, we do have some table service. If it's super, super crowded and they can't make their way through the crowd very easily, sometimes that makes it a little more difficult. It might take a couple more minutes, but at least you wouldn't have to go stand in line and miss a song, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
And again, so again, the beer garden opens at 5:30. The concerts start at 6:30. Unless otherwise noted, there are some afternoon concerts going through here. With the bands, again, several returning, what are the ones you see people so excited about? And not to plug any more than others, because they are all really wonderful, but is there more of a buzz with some of them than the others beyond Vicky G and the Dudes?
Yeah, there are. Everybody loves all of them, but I can tell you the ones that sell out the tables fastest are Venice, which is not a tribute band. They're an original band, actually, a local SoCal band, which is awesome. And The Answer, Desperado, an Eagles tribute band, Queen Nation, Led Zeppelin, Which One's Pink, Van Halen, The Spasmatics, Dead Man's Party, All of those are automatic Full House.
Nice.
The
Good.
Ultimate Stones, Lights, Tribute to Journey. All of those are ones that we really like to get back every year that everybody loves and loves seeing over and over again.
Well, and they are all back this year. You just mentioned. Yeah. So thelakearrowheadvillage.com. It's just easy to go from there. You can go over to the events tab and go down its calendar and then the summer concert series. Your band is playing. That's part of the series as well. That's going to be around Memorial Day?
Yeah, on Memorial Day in the afternoon from 2 to 4 p.m. Yeah, we'll play in the afternoon for anybody who wants to come out and hang out and do a little Memorial Day remembrance with us.
You're one of the otherwise noted. You are 2 to 4 p.m. on that day.
Right.
But again, people can see the complete lineup at thelakearrowheadvillage.com and then just a couple more clicks away. So I don't know if this is really a safe question to ask. So here goes. What's your favorite? Couples.
Oh, my goodness. My personal favorite?
Yeah, your personal. And again, they're all great. Let's just get that out of the way. But I want to get people thinking in this direction. You know, why they like one? Is it because of the costumes? Is it because of the great songs? Or just you lean toward Oingo Boingo? You're that kind of gal.
Well, for me personally, I've always been a big Elton John and Beatles fan. So for me, I love Paperback Writer and I love Kenny Metcalf as Elton John. I would say, as far as my type of music and what I like, next would probably be the Eagles tribute, Desperado, Petty and the Heartshakers, you know, Tom Petty. I just love that kind of music, so I'm kind of a 70s girl.
Yeah. Some of the titles, too, I hope people have really been paying attention and maybe getting the connection to what group it was, but I love just the thinking behind a lot of these titles. Just Joshua Tree, that's for you, too. Led Zepp again, that's just funny. You know, it just goes from there. It's just fun stuff with that.
Yeah.
Again, the ending date of the summer concert series?
It's September 8th this year.
Okay.
So we usually were stopping the concert series on the Labor Day weekend, which would be like the first, second, third or so of September. But we have one more weekend before Oktoberfest starts. So I thought, well, let's just have another weekend of concerts. So we're going to go through September 8th this year. And that last weekend is a great weekend. We've got the Neil Deal, which is a tribute to Neil Young and Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young on that Friday night, the 7th. And then Uptown Funk, which is awesome.
Nice.
It's so dance music. Last year, we had them for the first time, Uptown Funk. It's a Bruno Mars tribute.
Yeah.
One of the newer ones. And last year, everybody in the whole place was up and dancing. It was fantastic.
Fantastic.
So that's going to be fun.
That was Vicki Goodglick, Marketing and Events Manager at Lake Arrowhead Village. Again, more information on the summer concert series and beyond at thelakearrowheadvillage.com. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. I'm David Fleming. Let's go now to Kent Hartman, author of Goodnight LA, The Rise and Fall of Classic Rock, The Untold Story from Inside the Legendary Recording Studios. First, Kent, thanks for joining us on KVC Arts.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Definitely. Well, now, first, I have to say, Goodnight LA, it's hard to skim this thing. I mean, I started to and just got sucked into reading. This is a series of stories and interviews and anecdotes. It all revolves around music and musicians that a person just had to be aware of, at least on a casual level, if not more. I want to point out kenthartman.com if folks want to check out more as we speak, including, I have to say, a blog that revolves around the lavatory at Ocean Way Recording. Yes, looking exactly as it did 50
that.
Years ago. No, don't be sorry. That was a curious piece. It's called, by the way, Where Frank Did His Business. And so this is going to be one of several detours, I hope. Tell us just more about who Frank was and the place in which his business was done.
Well, Frank, that's
welcome,
on my
Kent.
Blog, on my website, but I go to a lot of recording studios in L.A., and thankfully some of them are still around from the 60s and 70s, you know. So I go there and I hang with the people, and anyway, it just dawned on me one day when I went in the bathroom at Ocean Way, which used to be United Recording in the 60s, that's the bathroom that Frank used when he was doing Strangers of the Night, and they haven't changed it at all. Same tile, same toilets, same everything. And I just thought, well, since Frank was a co-owner of that studio back in the day, and I just got the idea to write that blog, you know, Where Frank Did His Business.
Beautiful. Any old graffiti on the walls from any of these guys sitting there killing time?
No, you would think, but no, the studios actually are pretty clean inside. They may have a lot of retro gear or retro fixtures, but they're not messy or dirty, and there is no graffiti. You know, you would think, well, they would save that. I know that the old Ed Sullivan Theater in New York has a wall behind where David Letterman sat that you couldn't see, where all the acts over the years would sign it, going back to when the Beatles were on Ed Sullivan.
Oh, cool.
I don't know who has that wall now, but somebody does.
Oh, my God. I hope it exists. That's something that couldn't go away.
Yeah.
Now, I really hope, as I mentioned, this conversation is simply a lot of cool stories about musicians and albums we love, including where Frank Sinatra did his business. So, the title of your latest book, Goodnight LA, The Rise and Fall of Classic Rock, The Untold Story from Inside the Legendary Recording Studios. Well, now, just with the beginning, Goodnight LA, The Rise and Fall of Classic Rock, you're kind of sucked in already. The title really kind of gets you as much as, say, a careful with that axe, Eugene. You know, it's just something that you want to listen or read more in this case. Let's talk about the title. It's, in a way, I guess, a simple description, but that's kind of a drastic title, I think.
Yeah, and it's not to say that classic rock doesn't exist today in live form, because you can go anytime you want in the summer and see Chicago or Paul McCartney or Kansas or any of those bands live on tour. But in terms of them creating hit songs or hit albums, they haven't been able to do that in 30 years. But that speaks to the quality of their music and the songwriting from way back when, because it still stands the test of time today, and it carries them through these concerts.
Before we go into Goodnight LA, I'd like to touch briefly, please, on The Wrecking Crew, the inside story of rock and roll's best-kept secret. For me, The Wrecking Crew is a part of the legend and lore behind folks like Glenn Campbell and Leon Russell, to name a couple. Explain for us, please, just what The Wrecking Crew was.
Well, The Wrecking Crew was the title of my first book. And by the way, Goodnight LA is sort of a follow-up to that. But
yes,
The Wrecking
okay.
Crew took place in Los Angeles during the 1960s. And it was all about this small group of session musicians that secretly played the instruments in place of the real bands on hundreds of hit records, and nobody knew it. So when any of us would listen to the Beach Boys or Jan and Dean or the Mamas and the Papas or Paul Revere and the Raiders or Simon and Garfunkel or The Association or on and on and on, it was The Wrecking Crew playing that. So when you hear California Girls, there's not a Beach Boy on there. They just came in later and stuck their vocals on there.
But
sorry
but
if I burst anybody's balloon out there.
Oh, well, it was my intention. I love getting the behind-the-scenes things on this. But some of the Beach Boys do play instruments on stage anyway, so it is a bit of a surprise for folks still to find out that it was Glenn Campbell that was playing the guitar on so much of that. So with that, the book, again called The Wrecking Crew, The Inside Story of Rock and Roll's Best Kept Secret, that started with conversation with one of the guys from Bread.
Yes, yeah. And by the way, for those who don't know, Glenn Campbell and Leon Russell were part of The Wrecking Crew before they got famous. And,
right.
And by the way, I interviewed Glenn Campbell at length for The Wrecking Crew book, you know, a number of years ago. And he told me those were the happiest days of his life. He liked those times as an anonymous studio guitarist with all of his pals better than he even did when he became a big star.
Before we even go on then, I had intended to ask this anyway. So with the recent passing of Glenn Campbell, I would love to hear a little bit more inside track stories on him, because you just mentioned something and beautiful right there, I think. But for me, he was such an incredible guitarist, going from a strum to a shred to wrap up so many simple songs.
Yes, and he and I talked at length about his guitar playing, and he was self-taught all the way, never had any lessons. He learned a few chords from his uncle, who was a musician that lived in Albuquerque. But Glenn couldn't read a note of music, and you know, later on when he was in The Wrecking Crew, he could have learned to read music,
sure.
But by then he had developed this fantastic ear and style, and he didn't want to mess up this unique talent that he had, kind of like the Beatles. Paul McCartney cannot read music, and he decided early on that with the success they were having, he didn't want to mess with the formula. So yeah. Same with Glenn Campbell.
Okay, wow. Well, that's, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Wow.
That's right.
Which one of the members of Bread was it that got this thing going with the Wrecking Crew?
It was Larry Nechtel.
Okay, Larry Nechtel.
He played keyboards and bass.
And what was it in that conversation? I promise we'll get to you a Goodnight LA here in just a bit, but I really, really had to hear more about the Wrecking Crew. That really excited me when I read that.
Yeah.
So what was it in that
conversation? It is a mind blower, isn't it? If, you know, if people don't know about it, it is a shock. But Larry Nechtel became friends, or I became friends with him, in the 1990s when the band Bread reformed after like a 20-year hiatus.
Yeah.
So I started working with them, doing some marketing and merchandising things, and Larry and I became friends, and he was in the Wrecking Crew back in the 60s in L.A. He was just an anonymous keyboard player and bass player. You know, Larry played the Hammond organ on Good Vibrations.
Oh, okay,
and
okay.
Larry played the bass on the first Byrds hit, Mr. Tambourine Man.
Right, right, wow.
And he played bass on that. Then you hear Rockin' Pneumonia by Johnny Rivers.
Yeah.
That crazy boogie-woogie piano, that's Larry again.
That's Larry.
I mean, that's what he could do.
Wow, and they came, as far as pace, they came down so many levels as far as when they started doing Bread. You wouldn't have thought that that was the same boogie-woogie guy.
You know, I was in a restaurant with Larry one night with another member of the band Bread, a guy named Mike Botts, who was the drummer.
Okay.
And we were eating dinner, and Larry was like shaking his head. He said, "I don't know how much longer I can keep playing this weenie rock." You know, but he loved being in the band. But anyway, but yeah, he and I were driving to a concert one night, and he just started telling me stories about being in the Wrecking Crew, and I'd heard vaguely about it before, but once he started talking to me, I thought, man, somebody should write a book about this.
It's one of those things that, yes, you hear of, but there's no way that you could just even comprehend the stories that would go on there, not just the levels of talent that are in that room, but the things that went on to make those albums that in and of themselves are legendary there.
Yes.
You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. We're speaking with Kent Hartman. His most recent book is Goodnight LA, The Rise and Fall of Classic Rock, The Untold Story from Inside the Legendary Recording Studios. That just came out September 19th. With this book, just the cover arts on Goodnight LA, even that gets you, I have to say. And spoiler alert, it's just a mixing board, but with the colors and arrangement, the angles, it suggests a warning of danger, you know, to me anyway. Who did the cover?
It was in-house at my publisher in New York. I don't know the person's name, but they did a great job because it's got kind of a film noir look to it.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we wanted to have that kind of a, like, you're right, it implies danger, and, you know, because classic rock was a lot heavier of a thing in the 70s and 80s than the pop music was in the 60s. You know, I opened the book with Charles Manson firing a gun in a recording studio.
Yeah, yeah. That's one of those attention getters. Well, you know, that's a good one to go. Give us something that would just really suck someone into wanting to read the rest of this. What Graham Nash would talk about, you know, the first cut on the album, you got to know the rest of it then.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, the book is filled with so many stories, you know, about Tom Petty and Fleetwood Mac and Chicago and Santana and on and on and on, the Eagles. You know, here's something really interesting.
Cool.
There is one band in this book. Everybody's like these heavyweight classic rock bands, great stories. There's one band that's actually in this book that doesn't belong in there. I had no intention of putting them in there. They belong in the 60s. Do you remember a pop band called the Cowsills?
Oh, my God, yeah.
They did The Rain, The Park, and other things. They did Hair, if you remember the hit single
Certainly,
Hair.
Yeah. They did the non-movie version of that bird out there, yes.
And they had a big hit with Indian Lake, but they were the model
Indian
for the
Lake.
Partridge Family TV series.
That's right. That's where it is, yes.
Yeah, and so they don't belong in a book where I'm talking about the Grateful Dead or Warren Zevon or Santana. But the weirdest thing is that they had a connection to one of the main characters in my book. And the next thing I know, I'm sort of writing some stuff about the Cowsills. And they had the most messed up family in the history of the world.
Oh, yeah? Who was the Danny Partridge in that one?
Well, I don't know. It might have been Paul Cowsill, and he's the one I talk to most. But, you know, there were six kids in the family, and then they had the mom, and the mom was in the band, and they all sang. And the thing is, the Cowsills really were good musicians. But they had this abusive father that just did terrible things and beat them all up all the time.
Ooh.
And they lived in fear, and it was awful. But, you know, it fit with my book, and so that's if you want a story that's gripping, that will suck you in, that's one of them.
Wow. Well, as we go into Goodnight L.A., and again, the full title, Goodnight L.A., The Rise and Fall of Classic Rock, The Untold Story from Inside the Legendary Recording Studio. I keep on accidentally emphasizing the untold story. We were speaking about concepts with the cover layout, and that was, again, you just in-house. Did you have any input into that? Did you say, hey, give us Danger, give us Red, Zombie Apocalypse?
You know, I was hoping for something heavy.
Okay.
And
you got it.
It was in my contract with the publisher. You know, once you have success, you know, with your first book, like I did with The Wrecking Crew, then you get to put extra things in your next contract.
Nice.
And one of them in there was that I had co-approval with the publisher as to what the cover would look like.
Oh, cool.
So they couldn't just put out something without my approval. But you know what? That was submitted to me as the first idea. I loved it immediately, and I just said yes, and that was it.
This is, I think, just the press release, or maybe this goes to the inside flap as well, the little tidbit on Amazon.com. With certain bands and a type of feel of music, you talk about the rise of and the demise of. That is kind of harsh, but it's true, though. With these folks that came through, and oh, I hate to say came and went because it still is with us, you spoke with folks like, gosh, Rick Springfield, Roger Hodgson with Supertramp there. You got inside track into Heart, The Eagles, REO Speedwagon, Chicago, you mentioned. Lindsey Buckingham and Patrick Simmons, I have questions about those as well, including some famed producers that folks wouldn't necessarily know about. But we're talking about Keith Olsen, Richard Dashett, Butch Vig, a couple of people, yeah, that I want to touch on specifically. You had assistants as guides, you say, from Keith Olsen and guitarist Waddy Wachtel. Now, Waddy, by the way, I have to point out, people should look him up, because once you see the picture of him, he's one of those guys that you don't know his name, probably, but you have heard him, and you've probably seen him accompanying somebody big on a concert somewhere. How did you hook up with Keith and Waddy, and what kind of guidance did they provide for you?
Well, again, kind of like the Cow Sills, when I started working on the book, doing research and trying to find what the narrative would be, they weren't even on my map. I knew who they were, but it wasn't until I had in-depth conversations with them that I realized, oh, they need to be the people to carry the narrative, because I've got all these famous acts all the way through the book, all these inside stories no one's ever heard. And I thought, you know what, we need somebody, I think, in the book who is not known but is in the music business, and we can sort of, as readers, step inside their shoes and see what they see and wind their way through it. And so that's why I chose Keith Olsen and Waddy Wachtel, because they were sort of the Zelligs of the music business back then. They were seemingly on everybody's stuff.
Thank you, Waddy!
I'm speaking with Kent Hartman, author of Goodnight L.A., The Rise and Fall of Classic Rock, The Untold Story from Inside the Legendary Recording Studios. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. I'm David Fleming. Up in just a bit, we have the origin story of Warren Zevon's Werewolves of London, some inside information on Fleetwood Mac's Rumours, and more with Kent Hartman, author of Goodnight L.A., The Rise and Fall of Classic Rock, The Untold Story from Inside the Legendary Recording Studios. Well, how did you approach who for interviews? Was it a wish list of those who could give insight? Or was it, I think it's this, you alluded to this, or was it a series of conversations that just kept hovering around a certain time frame and kept bringing you to something?
Every time I would have a conversation or an interview with somebody, it would spawn like 10 more ideas by me of like people I should talk to, or somebody they might have mentioned, or a friend of theirs, or maybe it was just like a, you know, really, and the stars aren't usually the best ones to talk to.
Right.
Because they sort of give you canned answers.
Yes.
And they don't like to take too much risk. But, you know, the best thing you can do is find a disgruntled ex-drummer.
Give us a good disgruntled ex-drummer story right now from the hip. Can you?
Yeah, there actually is a good story in my book, Goodnight L.A., about the now disgruntled ex-drummer of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, Stan Lynch. And so I was fortunate to talk to the engineer on Damn the Torpedoes was a guy named Shelly Yakis.
Okay.
Who has engineered so many great albums in rock history. And I sat down with Shelly one day, And he was telling me these stories about working with Stan in particular, and that Stan and Tom were just oil and water, and they didn't get along, and they fought. And in particular on that album, Jimmy Iovine was the producer, and he and Stan really didn't get along. And there's this great story in the book about, you know, he and Stan sort of squaring off in there. And so there's a disgruntled ex-drummer.
Is he by chance the former Heartbreaker that one of the guys is running a beach apparel store right now?
The bass player.
Okay.
Yeah. I think his name's Ron Blair, isn't it?
Okay.
And he did leave for a while, and Teddy liked to say that. He goes, yeah, he left the band to sell bikinis.
Yeah. I watched the documentary. I interviewed a guy that did a biography on him, Warren Zanes. And so, yeah, I got a lot of Tom Petty stuff there.
That book by Warren Zanes, by the way, is excellent.
Oh, yeah, I read that cover to cover twice. I mean, I finished it and started it again. Part of it was just because I was going to talk to the guy. And then the other part of that was just because it was so well read and so wonderfully full circle. Gosh, it was hard to listen to that, the old interview, because it talks about the next thing that Tom Petty could possibly do. What might happen 2 years later? And that's almost 2 years to the day when we lost Tom.
Yep.
Something else that is just a classic album so many people love, Fleetwood Mac's Rumours. We're talking about some of the things that went on to put these albums together, some of the stories that go on. Now, you can read anywhere about the divorces and love triangles and quadruples and et cetera, whatever, that went on with Fleetwood Mac over the years. But how about Rumours? This is such a well-loved album. What do we have on that? I'd love to hear Rumours on Rumours.
That was the least smooth album probably ever. You know, Keith Olsen produced the 1975 Fleetwood Mac album that had Rihanna and Over My Head and those songs.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the big breakout for Fleetwood Mac. And he did that at Sound City in Van Nuys, which is, of course, just outside of L.A. And so, anyway, from there, Keith was a great producer, but he had his own opinions, and Fleetwood Mac was strong-willed, and so they elected not to go with him for their next album, which would be Rumours. And so instead, they actually elevated their Rode sound engineer, a guy named Richard Dashett, who's a really cool guy, he's a friend of mine, and he was pals with Lindsey Buckingham. In fact, he was his best friend. And they elevated him to be co-producer of Rumours. And so Richard and I have talked about this many times, about all these crazy things that happened on Rumours. And am I allowed to use the word cocaine? That album was definitely fueled by it. I mean, that was their stimuli during that. In some ways, I guess maybe they felt they needed it because, you know, as everybody knows, they were all breaking up. You know, Lindsey and Stevie were breaking up, and Christine and John McVie were getting a divorce. And Mick was divorcing his wife, and so it was all messed up. And so that album, if people really listen to the lyrics of that album, especially the songs that Stevie wrote, they are about the other people in the band. She's writing about Lindsey, and Lindsey's writing about her, and not in a nice way.
Right.
And then they knew they would be forced to not only sing these things to each other in the studio, but do them on stage, and it was like the big payback.
Wow.
But regarding the drugs, you know, Lindsey Buckingham has said before that, looking back, you know, he said it was better music through chemistry.
Well, I built the horaphe, she's ready for flow. Oh, Mississippi, she's calling my name.
Okay, how about one more from this? Patrick Simmons, possibly my favorite Doobie. Where and when did that conversation revolve around? And I ask this really about a time period because there were several stages to the Doobie Brothers going beyond lineup, though their lineup is so much a part of that, but there were different feels to the Doobies. So when did you talk with Patrick?
It would be about 2 years ago, I think. I think it was two conversations. One, they were both by phone because he was on tour for one of them, and the other, he was back home in Hawaii. But we talked at length. He couldn't have been a nicer guy, just kind of a gentle man, besides being a gentleman. And he told me all sorts of stories, you know, about the founding of the band and the different iterations over the years and what it was like with Michael McDonald coming in and how that changed the dynamics and Tom Johnston leaving and then eventually coming back. And today, he and Tom are like the two original guys left. And, you know, he loves Tom like a brother. He calls him Tommy.
Yeah. He always was the nicest guy, whether you were listening to interviews or whether you catch them on stage, in person or on TV, I suppose I should point out. But yeah, he just always seemed like the nicest guy. And he was the one that was bringing kind of a folk element to the Tommy Johnston's much more rockin' riff-oriented music.
So. When you hear China Grove, you think Johnston.
Yep.
When you hear Black Water, you think...
That's Patrick.
Yeah, Patrick.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was one of those ones that was almost rejected, but but got back in that weird folky kind of thing.
And interestingly, they recorded the bulk of that stuff in L.A. They were a Bay Area band, but they would come down and use the Warner Brothers studios in Burbank a lot. And so, anyway, that's why they were relevant to what I was researching.
Well, there's something about that. There's a studio, for example, it's just outside of Boulder, Colorado, and it's a place that you would not think was a studio. It's just out in the middle of ranch land somewhere, and guys would be up there recording folks like, well, it could be Tim Weisberg, or it could be Dan Fogelberg, or, oh, gosh, it could be the two of them.
Oh, you mean Caribou.
Yeah, that's it, exactly, yeah. So this is a place that a person would not even think was a recording studio, and you talk about some of these places in L.A., quote, within the windowless walls of these well-hidden studios. I'll end the quote there, but so are we talking about places that, gosh, a person would just think it's a garage somewhere? Because we're not talking about going to the front door of Disney Studios and it's a big thing.
Yeah, nor did the people that owned it want you coming to the door. Not you personally, but people off the street. These places were intended to look pretty shabby or nondescript. I mean, in most cases, you would never know what they are or were when you drove by. There were a few exceptions. The record plant had a bit of a sign, so you would see what that was. But the Sound Factory, which is still there on the corner of, I think, Cahuenga and I can't remember the other street, but in the heart of Hollywood.
Yeah.
I just drove by there recently, and the Sound Factory is still there, and it was a huge studio in the 70s, still operates today. And the front door is on the side of the building, and it's got a security screen door, and the little, like, 1-inch by 2-inch brass plate that just says Sound Factory. So you would never know that was there, but that's what their plan was. But if you walked in, you'd just go, whoa! You know, there'd be all this gear and all these microphones and all these sound booths and everything.
Certainly not as played up as Sun Studios. They've got plaques and T-shirts and everything. If you just walk near the place, wow. You're listening to KBC Arts on 91.9 KBCR. I'm David Fleming. We're speaking with Kent Hartman. His most recent book is Goodnight LA, The Rise and Fall of Classic Rock, The Untold Story from Inside the Legendary Recording Studios. We just heard about one of the studios. Now, in this, anything I could bring up about some of these conversations, I mean, these wonderful glimpses that you've gotten, I would easily be leaving something out to ask you about. Here's a little bit of a preface to my question here. I interview a lot of folks from the doo-wop era, and really anywhere, but one of the things that I've really grown to love is these things that really surprised me, that some people, their biggest tune was the one that they hated the most and argued with their producers about. That's the framework for my question, and that is that I'm curious about a couple of items that really took you by surprise in these. Like, say that thing about Blackwater with the Doobies, you know, that was brought to them and almost rejected and turned out to be one of their biggest hits. Anything like this?
Actually, there's a great story in Goodnight LA that I wrote about Warren Zevon, and Waddy Wachtel was involved in it, and Waddy told me the story because obviously Warren has passed away, but it's about the song Werewolves of London. And so Waddy Wachtel got a phone call one day from Jackson Browne. He didn't really know the guy. He'd played on one of his albums, but he wasn't friends with him. And Jackson said, you know, I want you to produce the next Warren Zevon album with me. And Waddy was going, you don't even know me, man. You know, Waddy's like really outspoken, but he's funny. But he's so blunt, he's funny. Uh-huh. And he's a New Yorker. You know, he looks like a kind of a crazed Raggedy Andy. But anyway, he was friends with Warren and liked Warren. And Warren respected and liked Waddy. And so Jackson said, you're the only guy Warren will listen to. And it kind of proved to be true. So Waddy said, all right, I'll do it. So they get together and they are going to record the Excitable Boy album, 78. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so there's all these great songs that Warren has written, and they record them in the studio, you know, Nighttime in the Switching Yard and Lawyers, Guns, and Money and all these things. You know, and Warren Zevon was a very accomplished songwriter.
Oh, yeah.
And he was hoping this would be his breakthrough, and so they get down to the last song for the album, and it's this comical, goofy thing that they had cooked up at Warren's house one day, just like kidding around. Phil Everly, who I think was from Kentucky, right?
Yeah, actually, yes.
Warren Zevon used to play for the Everly Brothers in the early 70s when they were no longer big, but he was their piano player. And so he got to be friends with Phil. And Phil told him one day, he said, "Hey, man, a great title for a song would be Werewolves of London." And it was so random and weird, it stuck in Warren's brain. So one day, Waddy stops by Warren's house. You better not let him in. And Warren's sitting there trying to figure this song out. He goes, "Hey, man," he goes, I'm trying to work on a song called Werewolves of London." And Waddy just goes, "You mean, ah, like that?" And then they all start laughing. He goes, yeah, like that. And so Waddy just starts stream of consciousness reeling off those beginning lyrics to the song, like the first four lines of the song.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, and it just kind of flowed, and they were all into it, and they just loved it. But Waddy had to leave. He had an errand to do. So he just left. He goes, "Hey, man, there's your song." But he thought nothing more of it. So he goes in to produce that Excitable Boy album, and they need one more song on there. And Warren pulls out Werewolves of London. But in the meantime, he's kind of finished it. And so Waddy's going, "Really? We're doing this song?" Anyway, they decided to do it, and then they worked on it, and they ended up hiring Mick Fleetwood and John McVie to play bass and drums on it, because they had brought in about 10 other pairs of people, and nobody could get the right feel, because Waddy said, "Everybody wants to play this like it's a cartoon, but it needs to be done deadly serious. It needs to be tough and cool." And so they did it right. But then they thought, "Oh, well, this will just be the 12th cut or the 10th cut or whatever it was." And sure enough, the record label doesn't want any of the other songs for the lead single, but they go with Werewolves, which just infuriated Warren and Waddy. They did not want that released. And it comes out, and now it's a classic. And he did not like it at the time. And then I think in his later years, when he was sick, and he had a little more perspective, and maybe... not that he didn't ever have a great sense of humor, but I think he was okay with it later, and just thought, you know, it just kind of became what it was, and certainly he liked the royalties.
Yeah. Not going to complain there. I do have a couple more things to hear about, and these are really, I guess, opinion or conjecture, but gosh, you have had such a wonderful look at Somewhere in Here. I believe you alluded to this, but it really seems like Goodnight LA, The Rise and Fall of Classic Rock, this is something that was probably born out of The Wrecking Crew, just because of these stories keep on coming up and make you think of interviewing yet one more person. Is that about right for this?
Well, kind of. I mean, I wrote The Wrecking Crew, and then it just slowly started to dawn on me that that was only half of the L.A. story, that the other half was the 70s and early 80s when the music sort of morphed into what we call classic rock. And I thought, well, somebody better tell this story too, so I elected myself.
Okay, well, now this is, again, from just a press release that's just thought out well. Readers learn about how some of their favorite albums and bands came to be, and ultimately how fame, fortune, excess, and a shift in listener demand brought them down. So now, we often hear of the fame and fortune and excess portion of all that. Just watch VH1 Behind the Music on, say, anybody. Talk about listener demand for us. Was it just a change in radio? You know, the fact that radio became so genre-oriented as opposed to the stations that used to, say, play a more diverse lineup of rock?
Well, you know, that was a harmful factor to what we now call classic rock, because the fragmentation of the formats. You know, you go back to 1972 or 4 or 5, and you turn on just any FM station that's playing popular music, you know, you're going to hear Joni Mitchell one minute, and you'll hear the Doobies the next, and you'll hear Zeppelin the next, and it was that wonderful melange of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
That it's just like, wow, this is great. But by the late 70s, it started to fragment, and pushing it, you know, disco came along, and punk came along, and new wave came along, and you roll into the early 80s, and all of a sudden it's power pop and these power ballads. And MTV comes along,
oh,
and all of a sudden...
There's the pretty people.
...makes makes it almost more important what you look like than what you sound like.
Yeah.
And so, and it continued through the 80s. You know, we had hair metal by the middle 80s, and then we had rap coming in, and then by the late 80s was the beginning of grunge, and that really was the nail in the coffin.
I often look at grunge as bringing good rock back after all the pop and the unfortunate bubblegum that was a part of my high school years. I am, by the way, just old enough to remember the stations that would go from, say, The Carpenters to Kiss to Chicago to Charlie Daniels. So that was just refreshing. I'd love to hear that. We get that a little bit with album-oriented rock stations here and there, but unfortunately it's so much genre. So once again, speaking of Goodnight LA, the rise and fall of classic rock, and the full title includes The Untold Story from Inside the Legendary Recording Studios. Now, with that, anything that was left out of the book that could go into maybe a reprint, reissue, or maybe plant the seed for the next book? Anything like that in your files? I would almost guess
yes. Well, there are a number of bands that I interviewed that I wanted to be in this book, but I just didn't have room for them all, and I didn't want to keep doing the wash, rinse, repeat sort of thing.
Sure.
You know,
okay.
I wanted to keep it interesting and varied, but, you know, there was a band out of L.A. in the 70s that had a lot of hits. You remember War, the band?
Yeah, of course. Yes, yes.
I interviewed all the surviving members of that band, and it's just fascinating to talk to them. I've got hours and hours and hours of interviews on tape, and I really wanted to include them because they had some hair-raising stories too, but I just couldn't fit them into the narrative. So, I don't know. I'll use that stuff at some point.
Going back to the press release, or maybe to the inside flap or something, quote, "The combined forces of disco, punk, new wave, hair metal, rap, and finally grunge systematically pushed classic rock right off the charts, as well as many famed LA recording studios right out of business. Yet the music lives on," end quote. So let's talk about, why does this live on? What about the music that used to fill arenas? Why do you feel it's still here?
For me, the answer boils down to the songs. That's the critical thing. I think, you know, song for song, pound for pound, during the 70s and up through the early 80s, there was such a wealth of fantastic material that it stands the test of time. And so bands like, you know, Chicago or Foreigner or whoever it is can go out every summer now and just play those songs over and over because, yeah, the older people remember them and love to hear them because it reminds them of high school or whatever.
Yeah.
But, you know, you look at those shows. If you go to those shows, you will see plenty of 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds and every-year-olds. And there's a reason for that, and that, I think, is the songs. They've stood the test of time.
Oh, yeah, it goes beyond Guitar Hero.
Yeah. I mean, millions of people can play a guitar, but very few people can write indelible music that makes you want to sing along every time.
Now, there's a closing statement, if I ever heard one. Well, Kent, this latest book of yours, Goodnight LA, The Rise and Fall of Classic Rock, we've just hinted at it, barely dipping our toe into the shallow end of the levels of stories in here, and you're just fortunate to have gotten those. It had to have been a nightmare deciding what to include, because there's so many things that were just left out, I suppose.
Yeah, it's like a Sophie's Choice or something.
Again, I appreciate your time with me and with our listeners for KVC Arts, and I look forward to checking out The Wrecking Crew and speaking with you again.
Yes, thank you very much.
That was Kent Hartman, author of Goodnight LA, The Rise and Fall of Classic Rock, The Untold Story from Inside the Legendary Recording Studios. More at kenthartman.com. And that's just about going to wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Kent Hartman. Thanks also to Vicki Goodglick, Marketing and Events Manager at Lake Arrowhead Village. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Benjamin Perper, and Jessica Greenwell. You can hear past KVC Arts programs at kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.
Goodbye, all you people. There's nothing you can say to make me change my mind. goodbye.